It is a little complex to try and share chapters of the Bible, not my usual way of preaching, and it does pose some interesting problems. I trust that some of you had the inspiration to try and read the first six chapters sometime during this last week. If you didn't, you'll have one more week to read it this coming week, because I got three myths that I was encouraged the six chapters of Daniel tackle, and rather than racing through them, I've decided to do one myth each week. So we did one last week, one today, we'll do one next week as well. I said to you that the book of Daniel very uniquely has God's people in a very hostile environment. The world around was not friends to the people of God at that time. And throughout human history, that situation has repeated itself countless times in various countries, in various continents even. There are a small, mostly a minority of people who came to know that God was the one true God, and they, in trying to follow him, would be confronted by a culture and a circumstance around them that made it very problematic to practice faith. At times it was violent. It was a hostility at the level of such persecution that Christians could be killed for being Christians. At other times, it was just the fact that you were marginalized, that people spoke about you behind their breath, that they looked at you with disdain, that you were excluded from the public marketplace, that your opportunities in life, economically, job-wise, rank-wise, those kinds of things were limited by the fact you were a Christian. This is not unusual in the last couple of thousand years of human history, even 1500 before Christ came. Not unusual, and that's why the Old Testament still serves as a great lesson for how God's people can function in hostility, surrounded by those who have no use for either them or their God. And so in the book of Daniel, in these first six chapters particularly, as I explained to you, there are three myths that the surrounding world believed in that ultimately had to be confronted by God's people, and they were stuck either losing their faith or growing their faith in this contaminated soil of hostility, of not being liked, of being marginalized, the kind of reprehensible behavior that came when people found out you were one of those. And the book of Daniel is an inspiration as you see how people try to live in those environments. Last week we talked about the myth, oh, you can turn that on, sorry, as I always forget to. Oh, and Wes has just left the booth. Thanks, Vern. So, last week we confronted the first of our myths, and we talked about the myth of a hopeless world, particularly in an environment of enslavement, of persecution, where one nation conquers another, where people are repressed, where people are not valued as first-class citizens. One of the things that you struggle against is this feeling of hopelessness, that the world is never going to get better, that things are doomed to be bad for a long, long time. Thanks. Appreciate that, Vern. So we talked about that myth of a hopeless world as one of the three myths. The response last week that we emphasized was that in the book of Daniel, what comes out so powerfully is that God behind the scenes is constantly working to encourage his people as he interacts with them and with society around to create a situation where people realize that they're not alone. And so God is seen as the hope, not only of the people who are under oppression, but the hope for all who would be willing to admit that they're lost. So this God who is our hope is very, very strong in the book of Daniel. The second thing that is faced by people in this situation is that the more abandoned, the more discouraged you feel, the more you begin to question whether there is a God. And whether you were a Jew or a Christian, there come moments when you scratch your head and say, is this worth it? Can it get any worse? Why are things this bad? Is there a God who cares for me? Is there a God that cares for my nation? In this particular situation, of course, they are surrounded by people who certainly don't believe in one God, and if they are religious, then they believe in many gods, human gods that have been raised up to emphasize certain traits and characteristics that are, to people, noteworthy. So the idea of a godless world is really the idea of a one single God, capital G world. Religious people, of course, have no problem with a multi-god universe where many gods exist, mostly of their own making. I say mostly because some of them claim they are made by somebody else, but let's not get into alien theology. Leave that for another Sunday. There is a true and faithful, all-powerful God. As you read the first six chapters of Daniel, time and time again, what's impressive is the way that God inserts himself into the story. And he makes it clear that he is a God in control. He is unseen, but obviously intervening. And it is up to human beings to discover how he intervenes, what he's doing. A God who is unseen and obviously intervening is a God who, with power, will, and authority, acts out his purposes, but he does it unseen. The reality is, and as we preach this morning, as we round this circle off, is that, of course, the unseen God ultimately becomes seen in Jesus Christ. But more of that as we unfold this. So chapter 3, in terms of God's faithfulness and service, reminds us that God is the true and faithful, all-powerful God. He's the one that we get an account of. And in this story in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar makes an image of gold, and he commands that everybody bow down to it. So once again, we have Nebuchadnezzar running amok. He's been reminded in chapter 2 of God's power. He's been reminded of God's authority. But the moment a little time passes, Nebuchadnezzar says to himself, I'm not sure how real that was. That's a very human thing. We have these moments where God is very, very powerful with us. There are moments that are very precious to us. If you go back in your history, there's times when you've been moved by God's presence or by God's favor or by God's answer to a prayer, and that's been a very special thing for you for that moment. It gets increasingly hard to hold that moment in your head as time marches on. And one of the things that we as Christians are told to do time and time again is to remember, to reflect, to bring that back. But it is very human as well to forget. And one of the things we see in Nebuchadnezzar is how incredibly forgetful this man is. And by the way, just as we finished last week, forgetfulness is also compounded by pride. The prouder you are, the more we forget. Humbleness means that we make a commitment to remember more and remember better. At that time, things get worse again. The story of chapter 3, some astrologers, some of those people that hung around in the court with Daniel and his friends, they would have rubbed shoulders with them almost constantly each and every day. And these guys come forward and they denounce them. They say things about them that once again come on the king's ear. They denounce the Jews, they denounce Daniel, and the whole story of chapter 2 seems to be completely forgotten. Then Nebuchadnezzar, who also seems to have forgotten, comes up with this idea of an image of gold. He wants people to realize how wonderful he is, makes an image of gold, and then of course he goes through that long process of wanting people to bow to this golden image. And of course he is very clear that if they don't, they're going to be thrown into a blazing furnace. And then he says this weird thing, then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? It's hard to imagine this is the same guy from chapter 2. And that again, that's why pride is such a weapon. It's not hard to convince yourself that everything you thought about God is a dream, that everything you experienced before was probably just bad mushrooms, that every experience you've had was probably somebody else's influence, and you begin to talk yourself into an awareness that there probably is no God. That was all just rubbish. Children often do that with their parents' God. Right? That's why every child has to come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ themselves. There are no spiritual grandchildren, we say, because as much as we want our experience of God to rub off on our kids, ultimately, it is easy for them to dismiss it and say, Mom and Dad are just soft in the head, they're just weirdly religious, they've just come up with this, it makes sense to them, it doesn't make any sense to me, and so it goes. Nebuchadnezzar easily dismisses everything that has happened that was good in the previous chapter, the previous story, and he's spouting off his mouth. Who's going to do anything about it? I'll do what I like. What God can take you out of my hand? If there's any all-powerful person on the planet, it's me. Me. Right? So, he throws the threat up there. Ultimately, of course, you remember the story. These three young men refuse to bow down. They are faithful, they are trusting, they are humble. Like so many persecuted people through the ages, they refuse to lose their witness. They understand that the God they serve is real and they will not compromise. So even though they are sentenced to death, they are willing to endure that because they will not turn their back on God. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot. It's kind of weird. It's almost like Nebuchadnezzar is having a little tiny bit of doubt. It's almost like there's a part of him maybe when he goes to bed at night that says, don't you remember what happened before? Do you really think you're going to get away with this? It's almost like there's a little voice in his head saying, there just might be a God. And so he turns the furnace up hotter just to make sure that nothing weird happens. Because you don't want fluke. You don't want circumstance. You don't want something to happen where people later on go, well, you know what? You know, they only got scorched because, you know, you only put 3 logs on the fire, right? You can't even do a good marshmallow with 3 logs. If you're going to burn some human beings, you gotta make it really... So I better cover my bases. I'll cover my bases. And of course, they get thrown in the fire. Ultimately, of course, God intervenes. Fire doesn't touch the guys. They come out of the fire, and there's no smell of fire on them. And now Nebuchadnezzar is once again confronted with a God he can't explain. And once again, he breaks out in acclamation to the God he claimed before he didn't know. And he says this incredible thing, praise be to God, they trusted in him, they defied my command, they're willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any God except their own God. Therefore I decree, and he makes a decree, that nobody should raise a hand against them or their people, or he will take vengeance on them. The guy sure knows how to frame repentance. Like, he says all the right things every single time. I'm amazed. The dude is a preacher when it comes to right afterwards saying all the right things about what he learned his lesson about. It's amazing. And he promotes them, and you remember that. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar. It's hard to imagine that we're about to now jump into another chapter and see the guy do it all over again. Because that's exactly what happens in the next chapter. And you begin to wonder, do you have some sort of a memory disorder? Like, what is with you, guy? How do you go through these incredible moments where you are confronted with the evidence of a God who is real, and as soon as a little time passes by, you can turn your back on that and go, well, that can't have been real. And he flip-flops again. Chapter 4 has him walking around his gardens. Obviously, this now comes at a time of life when Nebuchadnezzar has finished building. He seems to have finally come to completion. We know that he built the famous hanging gardens. He loved to build great buildings and edifices and roads. It seems that he's come to an end, because in chapter 4 he's kind of walking around and he's very, very pleased with himself. He's walking around the city and he's enjoying what he's done. He's looking at everything that he's made. And once again, his pride bubbles to the surface as he walks around and says to himself, look what I have accomplished. Why, golly gee whiz, aren't I the best? And he walks around with a smile on his face, seeing all the things that he's done. And he has no sense of accounting for God at all. He talks in first person. I, Nebuchadnezzar, contented and prosperous. And then it comes, but I had a dream that made me afraid. The cycle is about to repeat again. And so we get this sense of a guy who again distanced himself from what should be obvious to him. His pride once again rises up. I don't want to believe in a God. Why would I want to believe in a God who directs my will, whose purposes are greater than mine? Why would I want to believe in a God who rules the earth, whose will cannot be defied? I'm a human being. My will cannot be defied. My life is about me. My life is about my choices. My life is about my decisions. My life is what I do. My life is about what I say is right and what I say is wrong. My life is mine. And he simply does it to the nth degree because he's the king of Babylon. But we all do this. And like many times when we get ahead of ourselves, when we get too big for our own britches, when we get our heads too swollen with our own attitudes and plans and dreams, nighttime doesn't go so well. Funny how we humans are. When we're supposed to shut down, and our body's supposed to get all that rest and relaxation and recharge for the next day, that's sometimes when the guilt begins. That's when the darkness pokes and prods us. That's when we begin to wonder, what am I doing with my life? What is it all about? Why do I do what I do? Why do I have such trouble with faith? Why am I so concerned to have things my way? In this case, he has a dream. A dream that troubles him and bothers him. And once again, he's looking for answers. Chapter 4 goes through the dream. Daniel comes to talk to him about the dream and about what's happening in the dream. One of the things that ultimately happens to him is he goes crazy. And when he's restored, he once again praises God. And after that, he falls right back into his old way again. It's a never-ending cycle with this guy. He's up, he's down. He's thanking God, he doesn't believe God exists. He thinks God is wonderful, he thinks God is horrible. One thing after another. And in all of it, Daniel tries to steer him into this understanding of who's running your life. What is going on? Is it a godless world that we're in? And the myth of a godless world is answered by an intervening God. By a God who interjects himself into our lives. By a God who disturbs us. By a God who reminds us of who he is. Later on, when we get to Daniel chapter 5, it happens again. Get there in a moment. God's greatest intervention is that ultimately he brings Jesus to be born, to live, to die. An unseen God who intervenes in our lives time and time again ultimately decides that as human beings, what we really need is to have a God in flesh. That an unseen God is difficult to believe in, despite all the evidences of the world that he made and the way in which we live. And so he brings Jesus. And that's why the Bible so categorically says that Jesus is the greatest gift. Jesus is the greatest revelation. Jesus is the greatest message. Jesus is the greatest hope. Jesus is the greatest demonstration of God's power, of God's love, God's mercy. That's why in the book of Hebrews, so often it will refer to other times, other places, what the prophets said, what the prophets did, all these great stories, one of which we're recounting this morning, and it will say those were all wonderful. They're great stories. They remind us that God is not a God who just lets human history unfold and sits in the background and does nothing, but he interposes himself time and time again and does what he can to help. But human beings need me to be enfleshed. And God's plan was always to give us Jesus. God's greatest answer to whether or not he exists is the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ. And by the way, I put it before the creation of the world, and yes, I know what Romans 1 and 2 says, but Romans 1 and 2 uses that primarily to say to non-Christians, open your eyes, this did not get here by chance, whereas Jesus is the demonstration to both his own people and to unbelievers that he is who he says he is, and that Jesus Christ is God. That's why I rank it in that order. Jesus is to have preeminence in everything. including the way God structured the universe. It's God's intervention that saves these men from dying in the fire. It's only God's intervention that saves you and I from dying in the fire. There's a huge parallel in the book of Daniel as it plays up this horror, this end that these young guys are supposed to walk into. And God says, I got different plans. And I will save whom I want to save. The secondary lesson out of this is you can survive. You can survive opposition, persecution, and government over and over and over again. In Daniel, the revelation of God to his people is don't get discouraged, don't give up. When times are hard, have faith in me. Remember, there is hope in the world. I'm your hope. Remember, there is a God in control. It's me. So you can withstand whatever is going on the outside. You can withstand the fact that the world may ultimately not like you like they did for the last 400 years or as much, especially in the Western world. You might be marginalized again as badly as you once were or as others are right now in various parts of the world. You may be marginalized that badly again. Don't lose hope. Nothing's changed. God is still your hope, and God is still God. You can survive whatever is coming. And that gives us that last interesting story in chapter 5. Daniel, the ultimate court survivor, still within the orbit of the king and his court in 539 BC. Now Nebuchadnezzar is dead, and the king is Belshazzar, although Belshazzar is really only the second in command. The actual king is away on a mission, and that's why later on it refers to Daniel. When Belshazzar wants to bribe Daniel, he offers him the third highest position. That never made sense to people till they realized Belshazzar was actually second in command at the time, and that his uncle was away. He was now just governing on his behalf, so he offers Daniel spot number 3. That's how that all plays out. And there's this drunken feast where, again, Belshazzar, who is just living it up, just doing kingly things, living the kingly life, enjoying kingly days and kingly nights, has this feast, and this hand comes out of nowhere and writes on the wall. You remember the story. And ultimately, he's told that his life is going to end. And Daniel says to Belshazzar, he says to him, you didn't know this. Verse 17, there it is. He says, keep your gifts here, and I will read the writing for you and tell you what it means. Your father, Nebuchadnezzar, sovereign, so on, because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples of the land dreaded and feared him. Then he goes through and he recounts all the stories that I just did to you, tells him how Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, goes through the entire story again of what Nebuchadnezzar learned, and then he says, you haven't humbled yourself, even though you knew all this. He literally just, Daniel, what am I going to do for you? Your people don't learn. That's what he's saying. How many times do we have to repeat this? Life is not a chance. Life is not meaningless. Life has purpose. There's a God who created you. He created you for a purpose. There is something that happens after life is over. It's not nihilism. It's not reincarnation. You don't get to do it over and over again until you get it right. One life, one chance. Belshazzar, you saw this. You lived it. You saw your father. You heard the lessons he heard. You saw what he saw. And what did it do? Yeah, I don't care. Didn't affect you. And ultimately, of course, even though he tells them what it says, it doesn't change the outcome. Because that night, Belshazzar dies. God ultimately, who rules life and death, it has been appointed once for human beings to die and then the judgment. We all have an appointment to keep. Belshazzar's was that night. And nothing could be done to change that. And Daniel survives. The book of Daniel is an amazing story that at first glance looks like it's about Daniel's faithfulness, when ultimately it's about God's faithfulness and what he does to work with us. Our strength is that our hope is in God, and that God has given us that hope through the gospel. We look back on this Old Testament story and we understand it in New Testament ways. We understand that God has said to us as his people, you will never be alone. I will always be with you. It doesn't matter how few people say they believe in God or believe in Jesus Christ, I'm still going to be with you. And you can withstand whatever is, whatever was, and whatever is to come. Have hope. Have hope. God has given us this hope through his Son, Jesus Christ. Jesus changes everything. In the story of the Jews, God behind the scenes is always orchestrating the safety of his people, the survival of his people, even when he himself is judging his people and punishing them. There is always a way through and around. And ultimately what he does in Jesus Christ is he gives you and I a chance through and around. Nothing I do earns me heaven. What Jesus did earns me heaven. Nothing I say earns me heaven. What Jesus said and I believe earned me heaven. God does everything for us so that we have hope and we have a future. That has never changed. One of the great rhythms in the book of Daniel is that in a myth of a godless world, there are people that live with godly courage, knowing that they have a God they can count on, a God they can trust in, a God they can serve, and a God who will look after them and for sure take them into the life to come. When those three guys marched into the fire, I'm not sure what they thought. I probably think they hoped God might save them. Were they sure? I don't think so. I think they just said, one way or another, we're going to live. Right? We'll die, but we'll live. God's choice is whether it's now or forever. I'm okay with that. God's people are always okay with the outcome that God chooses. And their faith increases. In a world that believes in a myth that there is no God, our response is in Jesus Christ. And in the same way that he loved the world and gave his life for it, he says to us, serve me. Love them. They don't know what they're doing. Love them. Let's bow in prayer. Father, thank you again. The myth of a hopeless world grabs us all from time to time. Things can be so discouraging around us. And we thank you again that our hope is in you, that we have someone we can turn to. We can have someone we can talk to. We can have someone we can trust. In a world that doesn't believe in a God, we thank you for Jesus Christ, who clearly showed us God and rose from the dead to prove he was God and gave us a hope beyond this life and saved us from our sin by dying for our sin so that we no longer have to be punished for our own sin. Father, Father, I'm not better than anybody else. In fact, I'm worse than a lot. It's not about a grand scale of who's better. It's not about who does more good things. It's not about nice people versus not nice people. It's about people who know Jesus and that he has paid for everything they've ever thought or done wrong, and people who don't believe in Jesus and now will ultimately have to pay themselves. That's the only difference. It's a huge difference, but it's not one that should make me proud or arrogant, and it's certainly one that does not excuse me from not loving not only my fellow Christian, but all those who don't know and don't care. So, Father, give me courage to live well in this world and to live it for you. Amen. Let's stand and sing together.
Let's celebrate our hope that we have that we're going to go and see Jesus in his place.